Hello, and welcome to Data for All, a quest for digital autonomy, a podcast in which we bring you closer to the topic of municipal data sovereignty. This season of the podcast revolves around sustainable data solutions for citizens and companies. Looking at situations across Europe, we present facts, approaches, and reflections on how we can better understand and use data for the public good.
Data for All. A quest for digital autonomy. A podcast from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, Schleswig-Holstein.
Hey Zora, welcome to the first episode of the Data for All podcast. I'm very delighted to have you here as my and the podcast's first guest. Greetings to Brussels.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I have already mentioned the keyword, Brussels. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners and what are you currently doing in Brussels?
Yes, of course. So my name is Zora Siebert. And I work for the EU office of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, the Green Political Foundation from Germany. And I'm heading the program for EU democracy and digital policy.
There have been some very new laws at the European level in the recent years, so-called acts in the area of digitalization, which we will discuss in more detail just in a moment. But first of all, to get into the topic, what significance do such acts have on the European level?
They are quite important. So in EU lawmaking, we basically have two different types of laws. We have directives and we have regulations. Now they introduced this third term of act, but actually the acts are also regulations. And I don't know why they call it an act. I think it's a PR thing because it sounds cooler or something, or the abbreviations are better with an A in the end. A regulation means it's a law that works European-wide and is going to be applied in the same way in each member state. A directive is a little bit weaker than a regulation, and every member state has to sort of translate it into their own national law. So it might be that, you know, you have this directive and it gives some kind of a guideline for something, but then the specifics in the different member states are still different.
So with the act, we have all like the same act within all the countries?
Yes.
We'll get back to the interview shortly, but first we want to share some background in the form of our first info box. In the next section, we'll be talking about rules in the EU regarding very large online platforms, or VLOPs for short. VLOPs are digital platforms, such as social networks, search engines, or marketplaces, that boast exceptionally broad reach and influence. They're typically defined by criteria such as having a large number of active users, over 45 million in the EU, considerable economic impact, and a central role in public discourse. Their influence stems from their ability to control information flows and connect global communities. Through algorithms that prioritize certain types of content, VLOPs determine what their users see, shaping purchasing decisions and influencing opinions in the process. This gatekeeping role enables them to dominate markets and steer innovation, often at the expense of smaller competitors. Additionally, their vast data collection gives them a significant edge in personalized advertising and data-driven business models. This combination of reach, data power, and market dominance makes them pivotal players in the digital age. With that in mind, back to the conversation.
Okay. So we're going to talk about actually one act right now. Today's episode is all about data sovereignty. And closely linked to this topic is a topic you also deal with at the EU level, the Digital Service Act, or DSA for short, which came into force some time ago. Could you explain the key points of the Digital Service Act? What is it supposed to regulate at the EU level?
So the Digital Services Act is basically the new European platform law. The intention behind it is to regulate big online platforms, not only when it comes to personal data protection, because there we already have a nice law, the General Data Protection Law, but also more things, and it has very big requirements for so-called very large online platforms. They have this abbreviation called FLOPs. So it's for very large online platforms and search engines. And very large in the EU means that it has, we're talking about 45 million users and more in the EU. And currently there are 23 very large online platforms and search engines that fall under the Digital Services Act. And they are also quite different. So it's the classic social network like TikTok, Instagram or Google and Bing. But there's also Amazon, Zalando. Then there are some porn platforms as well, Pornhub and Xvideos. But also platforms like Wikipedia because we have so many users on them. So they're quite different platforms. It's not just about Facebook and Twitter, but many, many different players. And it's quite ambitious. They have negotiated this law for a couple of years, and it was finalized last autumn. And since this year, it's in force, and the online platforms have to apply the rules now. And yeah, so basically this is the centerpiece of the European Internet regulation. And before that, we had the EU e-commerce directive. Directive, not a regulation. And that one is already 20 years old. And you can imagine the internet was completely different 20 years ago. So we needed an update, so to say, for our rules online.
I'm 25 years old, so I was 5 years old when this came into force. And I just remember my first mobile phone, which has nothing to do with the mobile phones we're having now. So just get the link to the data sovereignty. What does the Digital Services Act concretely have to do with the data sovereignty?
Well, that's a good question, but also a tricky one, because data sovereignty is a bit of a fluffy term. A lot of people understand a lot of different things under this. So if you think of data sovereignty, you can think of it's the individual's sovereignty over their own personal data and what can the individual do towards a company or towards a government. So that's one way of interpreting this term. But it can also mean for governments, for example, you know, having their own big players in Europe, for example, having the European Google or the European Facebook, and then we are not dependent on other big companies from the US or from China. So that's the more the economic understanding of data sovereignty. You can also think about it in terms of infrastructure. Who provides the infrastructure behind our technology? And there we are also quite dependent on US or Chinese producers of that. So it depends a little bit what you think. But from a user perspective, digital sovereignty means for me that I have control over my personal data and how this is handled online and offline. And yeah, with the DSA, you have a bunch of new rights on what you see online, what you can post, or if it gets deleted, you have the right to, you know, ask why. And yeah, so that's the connection with the Digital Services Act.
You mentioned there are 23 platforms that fall under those big players. I imagine that it's going to be very hard to control those big platforms. For example, Instagram, TikTok, they are huge. Who's going to control the regulations of the Digital Services Act?
That's also a really good point, and that's not going to be easy for sure. So with the Digital Services Act, the EU went in some kind of a learning process compared to the general data protection, because with the GDPR, it was the national authorities in each country that were supposed to enforce the law. And that didn't work so well. That's quite slow. And yeah, small countries don't have enough staff to enforce all of this. So they did it a little bit different for the DSA. Now the European Commission has much more power to be like the super enforcer of the EU digital rules, and there are around 125 people in Brussels in the Commission that are enforcing the law now and in the future, and this will be growing. But there are also the national authorities that will enforce, and that's, for example, in Germany, it's the Bundesnetzagentur, They currently have, I think, 25 people working on this. And that doesn't seem like a lot, because I heard that Google alone, for example, has 1,400 lawyers or so. And then we have, I don't know, 125 people in Brussels, and then let's say 20 people from each member state. That's not a lot. So we have to see how this goes.
Yeah, I think in football you would call it a mismatch. I think we to understand the Digital Service Act a little bit better for our listeners, just break it down to the users. Like, we as users, how will we realize that the DSA has come into force? So what will change specifically for the users in our everyday lives?
Okay, so for the users, how will you be affected? There are a couple of nice things that come with the DSA. For example, you have more freedom of choice. From now on, for example, social networks, they give you your feed with the posts of your friend, and then there's also quite a lot of advertisement in it and other stuff that the algorithm thinks that you like. So this is one way of showing you the feed. Now with the DSA, you have a choice. They have to give you a different option on what content you see. So it could be like you see chronological content and it's not algorithmically enforced by, you know, what the algorithm thinks you will like. You don't get that at all. Or you can say, no, I want this. I like some of the recommendations from the algorithm, but I want to decide what it thinks is important for me. And then there will be some parameters where you can say, okay, show me more cat videos, show me more food stuff, show me a lot of stuff from my friends, but I don't want to see so much political stuff, for example, or I'm not interested in motorcycles. So you will have more choice. In terms of moderation of content, it's supposed to be fairer. So when platforms impose restrictions on your account or on something that you post, for example, your account is blocked, your post is deleted, then they have to tell you why this happened, and you also have to be able to disagree with that decision. And it has to be easy for you as a user to also report when you think that somebody posted something illegal on the platform. So that is supposed to be made much easier for you. Then the terms of services are supposed to be more transparent as well from now on. There's supposed to be an online registry about all the ads that they show, including the target audience. So this is good for researchers. And if you see an ad and you wonder, why do I see this ad? Then there has to be a way of you to find out why you get this recommendation. So for transparency, this is a pretty good involvement. And there also has to be a direct contact person for you. So if there's a problem, you have to find it in an easy way, how to can address your issue to somebody, which is not always easy if you were trying to do that in the past. So that's in a nutshell like the things that will improve for the users. And there are lots of cool overviews in the different countries where you can check out everything. There's, for example, one website is called yourplatformrights.eu, where you can look at it and then you can check, okay, but how does it exactly work on TikTok, for example? And then they have an explanation. Okay, on TikTok, you go there and then you find your contact person. So that's pretty good.
That sounds pretty interesting. I think we can also show that link in the show notes for you to click on. So after those 23 big players, those big platforms, what is going to happen with the Digital Service Act over the next few years? Is it only those 23 platforms that will be regulated, or are there also like smaller platforms which are still big? And do they have to fulfill the same regulations those big platforms like X or Twitter have to do?
So the strictest rules are for the very large online platforms and search engines. The smaller ones, they have also rules, but they are less strict because it's considered a little bit less important. But if a platform is a very large online platform or not, that can change over the time. If, you know, a platform uses lots of users, then it won't fall under this rule anymore. But it could be that the platform grows and then it will be more. I think we started out with 17 and now we have 23 already. So on a regular basis, they will check, okay, who falls under the rules and then they have to report to the commission that they are all applying to the law.
Okay, so now we're going to an actually different act, so the second act, with another topic that has become increasingly prominent in the recent years. I just say ChatGPT. AI, so artificial intelligence, has kind of, not always, but has been there before ChatGPT. But I think with ChatGPT, everybody just realized how big AI can be and will be in the future. The EU Commission has also decided to launch another act in February 2024, the so-called AI Act, which will be actually the first law worldwide to control AI. So in this act, there are various risk levels mentioned. What risk levels does the AI Act describe, and what does a risk level mean?
Yeah, okay, so the AI Act is, like you say, another really important law. They were actually discussing this for years as well. It was voted and finalized in March, and it talks about three different kinds of risk levels. So we have the unacceptably high risks, those systems are forbidden. Then we have high risk systems, and then we have systems with low risk. And basically, the high risk systems are the ones that have the most specified rules in the AI Act. And there we are thinking, for example, about law enforcement or using AI in the employment context or in educational context or for border control. So these examples are considered high risk systems if you use AI in this context. And if you want to do that, they have to go through a conformity assessment. That's what the producer of the AI systems does themselves. And they have to check what is the impact on our fundamental rights for those systems. So you can't just throw something on the market and then, it's super privacy invasive, or, yeah, actually, this is very discriminatory, we can't do this. So you have to find that out in advance. And yeah, the AI Act foresees like a public registry where all these high-risk AI systems are listed. So people and you and I or researchers can look into it, and then there will be information. What does the system do? What is affected? And so on. So that is one thing. And in case the AI used in this context is not complying to the law, there will be big fines. And yeah, now I forgot what was the beginning of your question, actually.
Just to mention the risk levels, and what does the risk level actually describe? But I think you've already answered the question. So for me, there's always one example of regulations that might be forbidden. Maybe you can tell about this. So certain features of AI, such as social scoring, for example, which is intended to analyze the people's social behavior in a way, will this no longer exist in Europe with the AI Act? And what are other points where AI will come against a legal limit?
So that's a really good example. Social scoring is one thing that is forbidden in the EU. And another thing that was discussed to be forbidden was also real-time biometric surveillance in public spaces, for example. And there we come to one of the not so good outcomes of the AI Act. Actually, it's banned, but it's also not really banned, because there are a lot of loopholes in this new law. And if, for example, it's a question of national security, then you can actually do that. Then you can do biometric surveillance, like with facial recognition cameras, for example, in the public space. So that is something that is sort of forbidden, but not really, because I think if law enforcement agencies have the technology at hand, they can always, you know, justify it, why they had to use it, because they were thinking, well, it's a matter of national security, it's probably a terrorist that we are looking for here, so therefore we might as well use it. So there, this is one pathway where a lot of NGOs were quite critical of the outcome of the act.
Actually, the same question as for the other act. Are the same institutions responsible to control the regulations of the AI Act? So who's going to control the enforcement of the AI Act?
It's a little bit different with the AI Act. So for the AI Act, they are creating a new body here in Brussels called the AI Office. And they are recruiting at the moment, so it's all pretty much still in the making, and they will be enforcing. But there will also be national authorities enforcing the law. So it's again like this hand in hand. But if it's going to be the same people, that is still to be decided on the member state level.
Okay, so how does the AI Act will protect the users' data and so also us as the users in the internet? How are we going to realize that we're going to be protected through the AI Act?
I think the AI Act is not great for personal data protection. I mean, it's not a tool to protect users' data. It's more a tool for, okay, we have this great technology and we know there are these risks, but we still want to use it in Europe, so we put in some rules to forbid the worst stuff that can happen with it. But it's not per se a law to protect people's personal data. That's what we have the GDPR for. And sometimes, you know, all these laws are also interconnected. Sometimes it's a question of data protection. Sometimes it's a question of freedom of speech. Sometimes it's a question of, hey, am I getting discriminated by an algorithm here because I'm not getting my social benefits from the local authority because they decided to automate everything? And yeah, this is a good point. The thing is that users, first of all, they have to know, okay, is this an algorithm? Is this AI that is deciding, or am I interacting with an AI here? And if I realize that and I feel that I'm getting discriminated, then I can complain. So that is something that is possible through the AI Act. I have the right to complain. But first of all, I have to know that. And if it's a high-risk technology, then you have to be informed about it. So, you know, if you, for example, you apply somewhere and they say, we have so many applicants, therefore we are using artificial intelligence to help us go through all the CVs, then you are informed, okay. And then potentially you could say, okay, I want to know more about the system that you're using because I want to make sure that you're, you know, it's not bias or something against people like me. And then you can do that. But in this example, would you really do that? Because that could maybe mean that the job interview process is over for you. So it's a tricky question.
Looking into the future, the EU was the first one worldwide to have such an act on artificial intelligence. Is it a good example also for other countries, like for the US or China or all nations, to give an example that there have to be regulations about AI worldwide, maybe?
I think it's a good thing that we have a law now, even if I'm not happy with every detail that's in there, because a law is something that you can enforce. If you just have ethical guidelines, for example, of which we have many, many, many about artificial intelligence, they are nice to have, and it's important to have this conversation, but companies can just ignore that. They can say, well, it's not binding, it's just a guideline, but we don't do that because we have our economic interests in mind. So it's good that we have this law, but it's very much a law promoting technology in order to create growth, in order to, you know, pushing AI on the European market. And I would have liked to see something that is more rights-oriented, because here we have the so-called risk-oriented approach. Okay, it's going to happen. What can we do that it goes well? But we could also have done it like with the GDPR, which is a rights-based law, where we look at, okay, which will be the fundamental rights affected by the people? And then we look at this from this angle. So it's slightly different here. And I think it will have an impact also on other countries, because the technology is there and they also need to regulate how people and companies and governments deal with it. It would be good if one day we can align on the international level. So there are lots of fora where people talk about it, already, like the OECD or the United Nations. So it's good to have these conversations, because there's no point if Europe makes a set of rules, but then in all other corners of the world, the rules are completely different.
So I think that is something up to the future, and I'm very excited to see regulations about the AI Act and also the DSA, how they're going to be implemented and how we as users will see them in the future. So far, so good. Thank you very much for this, very exciting interview, the first one so far, and many more to come.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was all for this episode. If you'd like to hear more, subscribe to Data for All, A Quest for Digital Autonomy, in the podcast app of your choice, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. And for any questions or suggestions, you can write to us at dataforall@boell-sh.de. The link is in the show notes.
Data for All. A Quest for Digital Autonomy. A podcast from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, Schleswig-Holstein.